From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. So, how bad is the financial bleeding? That was the question behind the questions at a big economic conference last week. Ben Bernanke chairs the powerful Federal Reserve System. He didn't say the nation was in recession, but he did pledge that government would do something soon to give the economy a boost.
In light of recent changes in the outlook and the risks to growth, additional policy easing may well be necessary. The committee will, of course, be carefully evaluating incoming information bearing on the economic outlook. Based on that evaluation, we stand ready to take substantive additional action and provide adequate insurance against downside risks.
To put it plainly, the Federal Reserve is looking hard at cutting its interest rates to banks again. The Fed has so far cut one full point from the short-term interest rate since last September, and another cut is in the works. Will this be enough to stop a cycle where people lose their homes, big banks take a financial hit, and big-time international investors swoop in and buy up chunks of American companies? For more on that, we've got Bill Spriggs. He is professor and chair of economics at Howard University. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
So Bernanke says the Fed plans to take, quote, substantive action. What does that mean?
Well, they've made several interest rate cuts. I think what he means or maybe foretelling is that they understand those cuts may have to be bigger and they may have to accelerate them.
Now, explain how a cut like that trickles down to somebody getting a paycheck. I mean, when the Fed makes a cut to banks, how does that affect people on the day-to-day? What's the sort of domino effect?
Well, it makes it easier for banks to make loans. It makes the money cheaper for them to make loans. And it sends a signal that the Fed would really like for them to be making loans. And the real worry here is what will happen to corporations. Will corporations find enough liquidity? If the economy slows down, will they be able to borrow enough money to keep themselves afloat? And that's the concern. So it filters down to folks because if companies are able to keep getting money, they keep making payroll and people keep their jobs. If the companies find it difficult to get money, then it means they have to start laying people off.
Let's pull out a little bit to the political picture. Democrats and Republicans in Congress and also ones on the campaign trail are looking at a bunch of options to see what they can do to give the economy a jolt. So there's a plan for one-time rebate checks, extended unemployment benefits, higher food stamp payments. The president announced that he's considering a range of options. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has gotten into the mix. In your opinion, let's just break them down one by one, those three proposals. What might they do to the economy? One-time rebate check, what would that do? Basically, you're getting a little bit of money back for just one quick pay-your-bills moment.
That's the idea, is to help people pay their bills, to keep them from retrenching and buying stuff. You know, the big worry this past December from retailers was that people didn't spend as much money as we had hoped, and people are very nervous in the retail sector that as folks pay higher mortgage payments or are paying more for gasoline, then that's less money that will go into the retail sector, and that's what keeps generating jobs. So the nervousness here is that if we don't put some money in people's hands right away, that sales will drop dramatically.
But what if the government does give a one-time check and then people spend it, and then it's like, well, what am I supposed to do now?
Well, most recessions are short-term, and the hope is that if we can just get people past a couple of months, that the economy will right itself. That's the hope. It may take more than that, and that's why you hear people talking about extended unemployment benefits and looking at some other fixes in addition to the sort of instant money in your hand solution.
There were tax rebates given in 2001. Was there any evidence that those helped the economy?
Not very much. They weren't as targeted as they should have been. You really need to put them in the hands of working people, those who take most of their paycheck and spend it right away. They're the ones who are hurt first and deepest when there's a recession. They tend to be the ones who lose their jobs. So it's very helpful to target and make them big enough that people will actually be able to spend the money.
Now, let's take a look at the whole question of the unemployment rate. The Labor Department released unemployment figures earlier this month, and the jobless rate hit 5% in December. It was a two-year high for the U.S. What's behind the unemployment rate, Bill?
Well, in this case, it was that the retail sector started laying off workers already, and that was because they thought they were going to have a weak December. They did have a weak December. Whether that means that we will see more layoffs coming, we'll have to see when the numbers come out again, but I would suspect that there still would be weakness there. The only sort of net job growth was happening in the government sector. So we have continued weakness in construction, and we'll have even more because we know that home sales are going down, new home sales are continuing to fall, and there's no need to hire construction workers when there's a backlog of homes that need to be sold. And then we have the problem of manufacturing. Even though the dollar is very weak and exports are showing some strength because it's cheaper for people in other countries now to buy American goods with the dollar being cheaper, we're still losing manufacturing jobs. So it looks very scary out there. Individuals are carrying a huge amount of debt. And not only are they getting behind on homes, because we've seen the news about foreclosures, but they're getting behind on credit cards as well.
When you say, when you basically explain what sectors jobs are disappearing from, are we talking about, with homes, it sounds like, and this could take a while, that people are not going to get construction jobs because there's no need to build new homes because people don't have the money to buy homes. But housing can be cyclical. Manufacturing, is that something that's just gone or disappearing from America? Is there a chance that manufacturing is going to rally in the future?
Well, that's the big problem in figuring out what would the recovery look like if we went into a recession. If you look at the 10 highest paying industries in the United States, many of those are manufacturing, and most of those, as you just mentioned, are showing trends that have nothing to do with the business cycle, because during the expansion, they were shedding jobs right and left. They're continuing to shed jobs. So the problem is, for those jobs that are providing higher pay, they're disappearing. And the one sector that had been providing jobs, the financial sector, we know is very weak right now. So the recovery is a big question mark. Where would we generate the jobs to spur this recovery?
If you were giving advice, this is wearing a different hat, but you are at Howard University. Mm-hmm. If you were giving advice to someone who said, you know what, I want to go into a field where I never have to worry about getting a job, where people are going to beat down the path to my door and ask me to work for them, what would you tell them?
Well, the one area where we are growing is in health. That is a sector which continues to eat up a lot more of our dollar bills here in the state. So there's no doubt that health-related fields are going to continue to grow, and that's a safe industry. But the other industries at the moment, even the ones we used to tell people about, information industries, being a web publisher, being a computer programmer, those jobs showed weaknesses during this past recovery. So it is a puzzle. We do need a stronger safety net. It's good that politicians are talking about extending unemployment benefits now and not waiting until we get to the crisis point where the extended benefits could potentially run out on folks if we don't put them in place now.
What about this idea of discouraged workers, people who might not even show up on the charts? Do we have any information on people like that?
Well, we do. We keep track of two important ratios. The employment to population ratio is the share of people who have a job, and unemployment are just people who are looking for a job but can't find one. Discouraged workers so fall in between those two key numbers because they would include the folks who don't have a job, and so they influence the employment to population ratio. We are very close, but not quite close enough to the records we reached in 2000 when it comes to unemployment. We're farther away on the employment to population ratio. We don't have the same share of workers out there with jobs as we did back at the peak in 2000. So that's where the discouraged worker effect comes in. There are a number of people who just have not come back to the labor force during this recovery. Women dropped out of the labor force. Younger people did not enter the labor force. So those are two key populations that are very sensitive to whether we're really generating a lot of jobs.
So when you talk about women and young people being vulnerable, what kind of programs or structures help change that? Things like Job Corps, do they work? I mean, you know, if someone gave you a discretionary $500,000 to evaluate, you know, what works, what would you bet would come out of your research?
Well, we know that younger workers are going to have a harder time transitioning out of high school. So, yes, things like a Job Corps type program to help the very young workers. In this current recovery, it was actually workers a little older. Educated workers were having a hard time making the transition. And you have to raise wages in order to get women into the labor force, and wages weren't increasing at a fast enough rate during this recovery. So without the wage growth, a lot of women stayed home. They didn't return to the labor market once they left during the recession. So those are two elements. You have to do something to keep wages up, and you have to do something to help with the transitions between school and work.
Well, Bill, we will certainly ask you more about that in the future. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Bill Spriggs is professor and chair of economics at Howard University in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Call it the tear scene round the world. Did Senator Hillary Clinton's emotional moment help her win New Hampshire, or was it a stunt? Also, we debate the latest on Marion Jones's jail time for steroid doping. Our bloggers on tap today are Robert Redding. He publishes the ReddingNewsReview.com. Valencia Rahner, she runs the blog Why Black Women Are Angry. And Eric Brown, blogger for the Detroit News' political and government blog. Thanks for joining me, folks.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And thanks for having us.
So it has launched thousands of blog posts, Senator Hillary Clinton getting a little teary-eyed as she spoke to voters in a New Hampshire cafe. She went on to win. Robert, you blogged about this in a posting titled Hillary Cries, Save Me from the Black Man, and it works.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that, you know, it's easy to talk about Hillary Clinton and talk about the whole Bill Clinton comment about it being a fairy tale, and it's easy to talk about the MLK comment, but it's a lot harder to talk about what's behind that and what made voters not vote for Barack Obama. And what made voters not vote for Barack Obama is the fact that white women in this country have been glamorized. And when one is in distress, and this is what I talk about in the article, when one is in distress, people rally around her, and that's what clearly happened in this race. Now, I don't know whether that was a plan, but that is what the Clinton administration that is trying to get back into the White House did, clearly.
Valencia, on your blog, you've written a few entries about Senator Clinton, and you talk about what you call your own Hillary moment. What is that?
Just last week, I was having not a great day, and I broke a guardrail in a parking structure, a wooden guardrail, and I just didn't know what to do. I was frustrated, and I just cried. And I didn't know if I had to pay for it or what the ramifications were. And the owner of the parking lot said, listen, don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. And he even paid for my parking. So the tears worked for me in that case.
So are you basically saying that you think you were manipulative, or that although you were honest, it was still, you know, your feminine reaction that got you a break? I mean, explain to me a little bit more about how you see, one, what was your level of honesty? And two, was it a question of how people perceive women in distress?
I think it's a question of how women perceive people in distress, because I was raised to be strong, standing on 2 feet. I mean, tears are just not the first thing that comes to mind when I'm trying to manage a circumstance or situation. But in this case, I was just overwhelmed and frustrated because I was already having a challenging day. And before I knew it, the tears came, and they, in this case, a man, or men, because it was a tendency as well, responded. Now, I'm appreciative. I would have liked to thought about handling it another way. I was not trying to be manipulative. It's just how it unfolded.
Eric, do you think that crying in public is a sign of weakness? Is it manipulative? I mean, I know that I've cried in public. You know, I've cried in an airport. I've cried on the job. And I have to say, thank goodness it's rare. But sometimes it happens. I mean, and there's a difference between the honest form and the manipulative form. And there are variations on that. But do you think it's considered a sign of weakness anytime you cry in public?
I mean, I won't necessarily say it's a sign of weakness when you cry in public. One of the issues I have with what happened last week is the fact that the way it was played out and was not being said about the person that even asked the question. The person that asked the question was a Barack supporter. And that person was not swayed by the emotions displayed by Hillary Clinton. As a matter of fact, the person still went on to vote for Senator Obama. And we have to be careful as a society, because had that been one of the male contenders for the presidency, he would have been ran over the coals had he displayed that type of emotion.
Do you agree with that, Valencia, that a guy could never cry?
I most certainly do. I think
boys don't cry.
Yeah, and also, too, I think that there's this understanding in society that women are just different from men. Women respond differently to things than men respond to, and it is what it is. And so because we are made up the way we are as women and men are the way they're perceived and made up as they are as men, it's just perceived differently.
I want to move on to the Michigan primary. Got some more from the Clinton camp, this time courtesy of Bill Clinton. Last week, the former president, had this to say about Barack Obama's bid for the White House.
It is wrong that Senator Obama got to go through 15 debates trumpeting his superior judgment and how he had been against the war in every year and never got asked, well, how could you say that when you said in 2004 you didn't know how you would have voted on the resolution? You said in 2004 there was no difference between you and George Bush on the war, and you took that speech you're now running on off your website in 2004, and there's no difference in your voting record in Hillary's ever since. Give me a break. This whole thing is the biggest fairy tale I've ever seen.
Some people took offense, including Representative James Clyburn, the South Carolina Democrat. He said it was insulting. So last Friday, President Clinton went on Al Sharpton's radio show. He apologized for the comment, tried to explain his position. Valencia, what did the president, former President Clinton, say he meant by that statement?
As I understood him, he meant that he was talking about Barack Obama's position on the war, and he was trying to compare and contrast his position as it compared to his wife's position. And quite frankly, Bill Clinton is a man trying to get he and his wife back in the White House, and he's trying to protect his woman.
He's working so hard that it seems he's almost lost his voice.
Absolutely. And also, too, keep in mind that Bill Clinton was also on Michael Bazin's show last week, and I'm telling you, those calls came in fast and furious, and people were very, very upset. So this whole notion by the Clinton campaign that Barack Obama's people are edging this on, they continue to threaten, they continue to make us look like we can't think for ourselves. We don't need Obama's campaign or anyone else to tell us when we're offended. We know offense when we hear it. So they need to regroup, in my opinion.
Eric, what's the fallout from this?
Well, the fallout is the fact that you have a lot of African Americans that probably were so into the Hillary Clinton camp for whatever reason that have now taking a step back to say, wow, is she really the one I want to support? And why am I supporting her in the first place? Because most people believe that they are getting Bill back in the White House for whatever reason. And this blind loyalty and support towards her is a major problem for me. I mean, I would eat 100 rats before I vote for her. I just won't do it.
Why? Are you saying that's what...
For one.
Go ahead.
For one, I don't think she has the record to stand on. She talks about all this experience, and when you have only been in the Senate for what's going on, she's in her eighth year. I don't look at her experience as the First Lady of Arkansas or the First Lady of the country as a person that was elected to that position. Being the wife of the person that was elected, it comes with the territory that you are the First Lady. Therefore, she had no decision-making processes in the White House, no decision-making processes in Arkansas. So where is all this experience coming from? People are buying into the fact that, yes, she does have experience. I mean, show me.
Robert, that's actually become one of these political battle, talking point battles of whether or not she is overselling her experience and saying how many years of experience she's had. Does that issue come up for you as you think about this race?
Well, I'm an independent, and I agree with a lot of what has already been said. Let me just say that Hillary Clinton's a very smart woman. I think that she is not good for the black community. I don't think Bill Clinton, just because he got a relationship on in the White House, whatever you want to call it, on in the White House, or the Clintons have been good for black America. Look at our imprisonment rate in the black community. People overlook that. But I think she's a smart woman. But at the end of the day, I don't think she or Barack Obama are the right people for the jobs. While we're talking about fairy tales, that label applies to both of these people.
All right. Well, before we continue, I just want to reintroduce who we are, what we're doing. This is NPR's News and Notes. I am Farai Chidea, and this is our Bloggers Roundtable, where someone will always get you angry. We were just talking to Robert Redding. He publishes the ReddingNewsReview.com. Valencia Rahner, she runs the blog Why Black Women Are Angry. And Eric Brown, blogger for the Detroit News' political and government blog. I actually want to continue with the whole political juggernaut. Hillary Clinton was speaking with a Fox News reporter. She had her say on comparisons between Barack Obama and Martin Luther King. Here's her take on the role of the presidency in making civil rights a reality.
Dr. King's dream began to be realized when President Lyndon Johnson passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It took a president to get it done. That dream became a reality because we had a president who said, we're going to do it, and actually got it accomplished.
All right, Valencia, more people a little tweaked at this?
Yeah, I wasn't necessarily offended personally because I understood what she was trying to say. What I found more offensive, if there were other comments that weren't played just now, where she spoke about how Martin Luther King had to get attacked by dogs and endured hoses. I mean, like, is that what it takes to be qualified to be president? Or I took offense more personally when she spoke about how Barack Obama, as he referenced JFK and Martin Luther King, like he didn't have a right to reference them in terms of how he's been inspired by them. She said, well, he compared himself to them, and he didn't. He just referenced them as he spoke about hope and encouragement and change and what is motivating him to take this on. So, again, I think that they continue, the more they talk, the more it's like open mouth and insert foot.
Eric, you are based in Detroit. Michigan has had its beef with the national parties because the state moved up the primary dates. When you think about issues like the ones that we've been talking about, the sort of level of debate between these two camps, how is your area, your state, your city faring in terms of getting attention from the candidates, having your issues heard?
Well, there is no attention from the candidates other than the Republican Party. And like Robert, I'm an independent as well. And I think that the Democratic Party did themselves a disservice by not staying with the game plan as it relates to the National Democratic Committee. I think they also did themselves a disservice by taking themselves off the ballot. The governor of the state of Michigan has endorsed the New York senator. And one of the reasons she says that she endorsed it because the senator from New York is brave enough to keep her name on the ballot. Well, I think that's a slap in the face to anyone that's a Democrat. And woe be them for being, who they are, to continue to support a party. But though she is on the ballot, she still has not come here to campaign. So she is just as wrong as Senator Obama, former Senator Edwards, and anyone else that took their names off the ballot. But I guess in the sense she played the game and felt that I keep my name on the ballot, no matter how many votes I get, I will win the Michigan Democratic primary. But she still has done a disservice to her party as well as to the Democratic electorate in Michigan.
Robert, when you see what's been going on with the primaries, every state wanting its chance to move on up. Reminds me of that game, Mother May I, where everybody's trying to edge up and edge up. Is this sustainable? Meaning, is the primary system as it stands sustainable, or will we have to move to some kind of a national primary if every state just says, I want to move up?
Absolutely not. This is ridiculous. The way it's working right now, we have New Hampshire always trying to be first and historically being first. That's what their argument. You have D.C. that there's very little talk about D.C.'s primary, which moved up last time. I'm not sure what they're doing this year. My whole point is at this point, I think they should probably look at going to some type of lottery system or look at doing something a little different, because right now we have an election process that started a year ago, and we have a year to hear from two candidates, and that's a mighty long time. And that favors someone like Barack Obama, who doesn't have a lot of experience, because it seems like he's been running for an awful long time. Remember, he announced back in January, last January, that he was running.
All right, guys, we have just a smidgen of time left, and I want us to take a quick leap into the world of sports. Marion Jones, track star, Olympic gold medalist, stripped of her medals, now sentenced to 6 months in prison. Valencia, what have you written recently about Jones, and how have your readers responded?
Well, I wrote on Friday when her sentencing was handed down that basically how sad it was. Obviously, there was some wrongdoing. She admitted it, and she's taking responsibility. But I have issue, as I've had always, with the unfairness in sentencing. I mean, here if you compare, they're putting her in jail for 6 months away from her two small children, where you have a teacher like Deborah LaFay, who had sex with a 14-year-old, who has still not done jail time. Oh, and on top of that, she violated the conditions of her probation, and she escaped having to do jail time again. So again, there's this whole notion and issue with the fairness of sentencing with people of color versus, you know, others.
Eric, do you see unfair sentencing in this?
I won't necessarily say unfair. One of the issues that I have been grappling with is the fact that, I mean, she did lie to the feds, and I guess the true test of that will come once all the dealings is over with the baseball situation, the Roger Clemens's, the Barry Bonds, and how that's handled. With regard to Valencia and comparing it to Deb LaFave, that was, you know, state and circuit court versus federal court. I mean, there are just certain aspects of our community, unfortunately, just can't go in front of a grand jury and lie to. There are repercussions, and when it's all said and done, perjury is a crime.
And finally, Robert, mm-hmm. what do you make of these tea leaves? Do you think that this is going to basically affect how people work from now on?
Well, I think it will. And watch out Barry Bonds, because he's the next one to take a big hit here. They couldn't get him on the actual use, so now they're talking about perjury, and those charges are, as we know, pending. So he's been out in the local press more than anybody on this thing. So if they give her 6 months, what are they going to give him, 6 years?
All right. On that note, I think we're going to have to let you guys go and have you come back again and give us some more of that hot buttered opinion. Valencia, Eric, Robert, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Valencia Rahner runs the blog Why Black Women Are Angry. She is here with me at our NPR West studios. Eric Brown blogs for the Detroit News' Politics and Government blog. He is on the line from WYCD in Detroit. And Robert Redding publishes the RedingNewsReview.com. He joined me from the Radio People studios in Monroe, Louisiana. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Birmingham, Selma, the March on Washington. There are places, moments in time that have come to symbolize the civil rights movement. And many of those moments, the water hoses, the racism, the dignity of resistance, were captured on film by photographer Bob Adelman. Through his lens, Adelman brought that iconic era to the nation, showing African Americans as they experienced historic events and everyday life. Those photographs are part of a book called Mine Eyes Have Seen, bearing witness to the struggle for civil rights. It's just out from Life Great Photographers series. Bob, welcome.
My pleasure.
So, you know, I want to talk about some specific photos, but first, let's talk a little bit about the book. It's quite a compilation. How did it come about?
Starting in the 50s, I began photographing African-American life. When I was 15 or 16, I used to sneak into Birdland and I saw Billie Holiday and Charlie Parker and Miles Davis, and rather than, I suppose, the historic view, I thought blacks were innately superior. And for whatever the reasons, my camera was drawn to them. There wasn't a movement at that time. I just found myself with a very rich subject matter. And as soon as I heard about the movement, I was very touched about when the students started sitting in. There was no real politics in the 1950s. But when the students started sitting in, that was real politics and real change would come from that. I just joined up as a volunteer with CORE and SNCC, working for them for pictures that would be used to raise money, to be put on posters, whatever I could do to help change things.
What about the photograph of Ralph Ellison? You captioned it, "Master of Them That Know." What do you mean by that?
Well, I had the great privilege of getting to know Ralph very, very well over the years, and no one had more understanding or insight into the American experience, and particularly the Afro-American experience. And I think today, in a certain way, Ralph would say, well, Barack Obama is about the right color, that anybody who is an American, part of what being American means is that we have absorbed the tragic history of race. We have hopefully pointed ourselves in a better direction, but certainly the tragic history of African Americans in our life is a part of every American's experience. And as Ralph would say, Bob, I don't know how black you are and I don't know how white I am. And it didn't mean pigmentation. It just meant that anyone who's an American, their language has been affected by the richness of African-American experience and expression. Our heroes, sports heroes and cultural heroes like Dr. King or Ralph Ellison, as an example, are very much shaped. We were dancing to African-American music. So all Americans are a mixture, particularly Ralph emphasized in our conversations, that all the great American writers, certainly of the 19th century, emphasized that a special sensitivity to African Americans was incumbent on all Americans because, you know, this country was torn apart by the race question and resolved it in favor of equality. Ralph believed in the promise of American life, and I think he had good reason to do so.
In talking about progress, looking back at one of your photographs from 1963, you see four young people holding hands. There's a crowd behind them. They're getting water hosed in Birmingham, Alabama. What were you doing there? What did you feel as well as what did you record?
Well, I had I was working with CORE and SNCC on the Postman's Walk. The demonstrations in Birmingham had begun to take off, and the police who had, I guess, exercised whatever restraint they thought they had to, had lost it. Bull Connor had called out the dogs and turned the fire hoses on blacks. And I went up there. I personally have never seen people treated in such an inhumane way. I was shooting the demonstration, and it was as wet behind the camera as it was in front of it. I was hiding behind a tree, and I think 20 years before, had the demonstrators been hosed, they probably would have been hiding behind a tree like me. But instead, they chose not to be intimidated. That moment where the use of force would break their spirit had ended, and they eventually turned the hoses off. Those hoses were so powerful, they could skin the bark off trees. A single individual could not stand up, but as a group, they could. And it became emblematic. That picture was used actually as part of the recruiting for the March on Washington. They made a poster out of that.
You mentioned the March on Washington, iconic moment, and you were there. It's 1963. Martin Luther King is facing a huge crowd. You and your camera are just off to his side. Why were you able to get so close?
I guess Robert Capa said, you can never get too close. I, of course, had, you know, gotten to know Doc, as we called Dr. King, in Birmingham. We stayed in the same hotel, which was eventually bombed, and had breakfast. And I guess everybody, in the movement knew me. The press was either on top of the Lincoln Memorial or someplace, up on towers or something. And I was in the crowd. I was very much with the young CORE and SNCC demonstrators. But I knew that when Doc spoke, that the place to be was, you know, on the podium. And I kind of moved up the steps. And everybody knew me, and there was nobody else there. And, it was just breathtaking. At some point, I guess he put down his speech and he was just speaking extemporaneously.
Why is this book important now?
Well, it took me all this time to come to terms with all this. So it's terribly important to me to have kind of sorted this all out and made sense of it for myself. But I think race is still a very difficult topic in American life because it's America's original sin and something that we all must do whatever we can to rectify.
Well, Bob, it's been great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Bob Adelman is an award-winning photographer and activist. The book Mine Eyes Have Seen, Bearing Witness to the Struggle for Civil Rights, compiles his photos of African Americans and the Civil Rights Movement. An exhibit of his photos opens next week in New York City at the Westwood Gallery, and he joined us from the studios of WLRN in Miami. Now I'd like to introduce one of the fiercest female singers on the R&B scene.
Well, my name is Ledisi, and what I'm told from my parents is that it's a Nigerian word from the Yoruba culture. It's in a Yoruba song, and it means to bring forth, to come here. It's Ledisi.
From her name to her music, Ledisi is a true original. Her music is a gumbo of jazz, R&B, soul, and blues.
Come here, baby, let me do your hair. Tell me, boo, about your worries and your cares. Explain to me exactly what you need. I'm here for you and I ain't no please. Ooh, I got your back when those fools be talking smack. Cause they jealous of this thing we got. I'm the one to be giving you.
Now, Ledisi's been nominated for 2 Grammy Awards, but she struggled for more than a decade as an independent artist. We asked Ledisi to lead us through her musical journey, including a time she sang with the New Orleans Symphony Orchestra when she was only 8 years old.
In New Orleans, when I was younger, we'd always have music around the house, so my mother and my stepfather put me in programs that were around in school, and I had a teacher named Ms. Ziegler, and she went ahead and enrolled me into the NOCA, New Orleans Symphony Chorus for the Youth.
What were you like then as a girl?
Oh, man. I was very shy. I was very, very skinny with big eyes. I was very awkward, and I got beat up after school every day. I don't know why. I don't remember. I was always the darkest one and just odd-looking all the time. My sisters are very fair and long, pretty hair, and I would just look like the oddball in the bunch.
We discuss color sometimes on the show. There's been a number of different conversations around it, like the light-skinned Libras. How do you feel about your skin now?
You know, I love my skin right now. I'm so happy to be in my skin. I started loving myself towards the end of my record, probably 2-3 years ago. It took a long time, to start loving myself. I had a lot of people tell me I'm not pretty enough. It was tough.
Well, I got to see you when I used to live in the Bay Area, and this is some years ago, and you just controlled the room.
When I sing and it's live, I become this other thing. I become this old lady preacher or sassy Bessie or something. You know, the audience is my congregation and I just do whatever and I'm real and honest and I pointed out the things that people don't like to talk about. So that's what artists are supposed to do anyway, to take people away from what's regular. And I love that. Live is just a personal relationship between you and your audience, and you get to sing and be. And sometimes we misuse that power. Let me hear you say it. 'Cause I've been here. What? Yeah, that sounds good.
Come on. You feeling good? Yeah. Speaking of things that might not make some people happy or going into new controversial territory, you did the song Papa Love to Love Me, and it was about sexual abuse. Tell me how your family, your friends reacted to you doing a song that really laid out some issues that people don't normally talk about.
Well, yeah, that it's a true story. Everything I write, it either starts with me or it's something I've seen or whatever, but that particular song was definitely a poem that I had written years ago, and we recorded it, and I was so freaking out the whole process. I can only sing it twice.
I remember it all like it was yesterday. I remember praying, Jesus, won't you come my way? I remember the liquor on his breath, his hand on my thigh. I couldn't scream, all I did was cry.
So then when it finally made it into someone's hands, like my mother and family, I was worried that they were going to be mad at me because, you know, in our culture, we don't like to tell a lot of things that go on behind closed doors. And my mother loved it, was happy that I told the truth. Sometimes you have to go through the pain to get to the healing. So I'm very proud of that I did that.
You have put a lot of work into your career, not just the creative, but also self-producing your albums, which can't have been easy, but this disc, Lost and Found, takes you into territory where you're a lot more produced. What was it like to give up that control but also get other people's talents into your music?
Well, for me, I produced everything with the producers that are on my record. I still had a lot of control. I had started on my record before I signed with a major label. I didn't know how I was going to pay for it. These were friends of mine. We were hanging out. We didn't have a plan. Everything was just, let's just hang and write something together and Led, don't stress about it, because I was really weary of recording again. I didn't want to go back in the studio and go back into the hot seat of pressure of being an artist again. I just really wanted to just teach and be quiet, you know, and not perform. I was really done with the business, and to have finished it and to know towards the end of the record that all of this is worth it, win or lose, I just had a wonderful time making it.
Tell me about the title track.
Lost and Found is about being lost in the beginning and then being found towards the end of this record.
Always alone, someone come for me. Here on my own, feels like the pain. An eternity, tears come no more. I want to smile again, love again. Please, someone find me.
Really, during the process of everything, I put my faith, I started to align myself in faith. And once I learned that, then everything else started to become clear for me towards the end of the record. It became clear that I belong in the industry. It became clear that I deserve happiness and I should start loving myself even more and just being happy with everything as I am. Because all this time I've been asking to be found, asking to be heard and listened to, asking for spiritual guidance. Everything just came. So when I finished, I was like, yes, you know. It was kind of like shedding old skin.
Well, other folks are finding you. You got these two Grammy Awards for Best New Artist and Best R&B Album. When did you find out, and what went through your head at that point?
Well, when I got a call about the Grammy nominations, I just freaked out. I mean, my mouth just dropped, and I just screamed and frantically around the house, just calling everybody I can think of. And I called my mom, and she hung up on me. So it was a great experience to have that happen. I'm floored.
Does it strike you as strange in a way that you have been in the game for so long and now you're getting a nomination for Best New Artist?
I don't know. Their definition of new is different from what everybody else thinks it is. So I'm just happy they think I belong in this category, and I'm very excited about it. I'll let others debate on that. But for me, I'm just happy to be a part of it, honestly. Nothing and no one can take this feeling away. It's exciting for me.
Let us see. Well, we wish you good luck at the Grammys. Have a great time, and thank you for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Singer-songwriter Lettucey. Her new CD is called Lost and Found, and you can hear two songs from the album at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. No spaces, just nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music.
A broken guitar.